Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back, and it is now or never. That debt is fraud, folks. We do not have any obligation of paying that. As a matter of fact, the foreign nations that have been giving us money, they knew well enough that what the federal government was spending the money that they were giving them on was unconstitutional. Even if they didn't do the due diligence, which they're obligated to do in going into a contract of debt or anything, they should have verified the legitimate authority to be able to spend that money. And had they done that, then they would say, no, you know what, we can't give you this money because you don't have the authority to spend it on what you're spending it on, which means that how are we going to get paid? This is fraud. And you're trying to make, so those countries that have been giving us money have been perpetrating fraud along with these actors, public servants, these elected officials who've been acting in our behalf fraudulently. It's that simple. So as I continue to admonish the importance of learning, and we're here to teach, we're here to help everybody, you know, get that understanding of what we need to do and why and how this all happened. You know, I'm not trying to go down the conspiracy theories, folks. I am literally going through the source documents to prove how this all really started going sideways. And actually, it started going sideways in the 18 teens, as we find out with the Enabling Acts, how Congress started aggrandizing their role in power. And unfortunately, Tammy, welcome back.
Thank you.
Tammy has not been participating in the reading of these documents because we need to get through the ratification debates as well. So we're kind of doubling up on you. I know I'm kind of like tag teaming. We got Tammy barraging you with the ratification debates, and I'm coming at you with these other source documents. But we're here to prove how they actually got, you know, broke the barrier of the Constitution, got the genie out of the bottle, and the full genie has been out. And the genie has been multiplying genies. I mean, it's... metaphorically, it is just hard to get your arms around, you know, equating this, because if you understand the true limited and defined powers that the federal government truly has, what it can literally do, legitimately do, is a speck compared to what they're doing. It's that big. So that debt is fraud. We got to learn, pray, and act. And everything we're trying to emphatically drill into everybody's head is the only way out of this is by demanding full compliance to the Constitution. That's what we have to do. We have to demand full compliance to the Constitution by every public servant. That means that everybody under the oath at the county level, it is their responsibility to make sure that the state level is doing what they're supposed to be doing. Why? Because the hierarchy is we the people. We're at the top of the pyramid. We are, mm-hmm. you know, we're the rulers here. You know, our government can only do those things that we've given consent to. And if they can, if they can get away with fooling us, then that's our fault. But we have every ability in the Constitution to hold everyone accountable. This is why we go through the importance of the oath of office, the First Amendment petition for the redress of grievances, as well as this thing called Section 3 of the 14th Amendment, the quick removal of every scoundrel who is refusing to fulfill their oath in supporting and demanding full support of the Constitution. Yeah, they're scoundrels because they're only doing things to ingratiate themselves. They're only trying to, you know, build a career of compromise. Anyway, I'll stop myself there because I could easily go on and on. All of these things are, you know, should actually embroil everybody. But the problem is we start going down, you know, these paths of conspiracy theories, you know, and learning about this or that. And folks, most of those things don't matter. Most of the conspiracies don't matter. What matters is the process of forcing compliance. You know, you can spend all your life going through all these different conspiracy theories and examining, you know, what's and who's and how's and where's and the costs, and that won't get you anywhere. That gets you nowhere. What's the most important thing that people have to understand is we have to start demanding full compliance, because where does the problem really stem from? Any ideas, Tammy? Who's really at fault here?
We are.
There you go. We the people. So quit worrying about the who got away with what. We're the ones that have failed to hold them accountable. We never challenged them. It's time. If we start challenging, things will fall into place. If I could get people to start realizing this, and, you know, you don't need to have a full understanding. Just get on board. Just, you know, give us your trust. Give us your faith and confidence in the Constitution so that we can actually hold people accountable. If we're all focused and said, I don't care. The Constitution does not allow you to do this, period. Anyway, okay, so the last little obligatory, I'd love to help you start an argument, because this is how we can actually start driving an attack, is using First Amendment petitions. And getting a First Amendment petition to demand that the people be able to elect their electors and take that away from the state legislature and the party who've basically absconded these things. They don't have the authority to do this. So, but nobody ever cared because, oh, well, we just trust the party. And the party has been one of the big culprits. Anyway, so... We're going through the South Carolina debates, and we're actually on, let me get to the date. We are on January 18th, 1788, South Carolina. And we have a General Charles Cotesworth Pinckney, who actually already addressed, we've already covered his earlier statements that day. This is the second time he's gotten up to speak a little bit more regarding the enumerations. So, and these are very powerful. As a matter of fact, I like to go through these with highlights, and there's a lot of bold words in this, don't you think, Tammy?
Oh, yes.
Oh, yeah. Okay, so I know that we actually ran this encomium. Okay, mm-hmm. That's the word encomium. It's a warm, glowing phrase, okay? So we're going to hit that word because this is the word we kind of stumbled on, but we never finished this. So let's go ahead and knock this one out here.
Okay. The general government has no powers but what are expressly granted to it, and it therefore has no power to take away the liberty of the press, that invaluable blessing which deserves all the encomiums the gentleman has justly bestowed upon it, is secured by all our state constitutions, and have mentioned it in our general constitution, and would perhaps furnish an argument hereafter that the general government had the right to exercise powers not expressly delegated to it. For the same reason, we had no Bill of Rights inserted in our constitution, for as we might perhaps have omitted the enumeration of some of our rights, it might hereafter be said we had delegated to the general government a power to take away such of our rights as we had not enumerated. But by delegating express powers, we certainly reserve to ourselves every power and right not mentioned in the Constitution.
Okay, so right there, is that not clear enough?
That's pretty darn clear.
Okay, so why is it that everybody, you know, is so focused on the Bill of Rights? The Bill of Rights were just further declaratory statements that says, you can't touch these, when they didn't need to say them. If right. Everybody understood that, hey, these things, because what actually they started doing was they said, oh, well, you know what? There's this thing of privacy, and let's see if we can use privacy to basically poke a hole in, you know, government's ability to regulate privacy so that we can actually enforce or protect the right of an abortion. And that's how they did it. They basically redefined and used something that was to protect the people from government regulating our privacy, where they actually started regulating the privacy and the protection. It's the same thing with religion. They're not to make any laws respecting religion. And what did they do in the Scopes trial? Oh, well, with education, we're regulating education now. We're going to tell you, you can't teach creation anymore. How is that not a law respecting religion? See, they've used the Bill of Rights. This is the work of the devil, because you talk about it, because you had those things there. And actually, whenever they bring up any of those words, you cannot make any laws respecting. So that means it doesn't matter if it's affirming or supporting, it's a law. Get out of there. You have no jurisdiction. These things never should have gone to the federal court, because the soothsayers and the forked tongues were capable of actually using those words against us. And that's how they've gotten another genie out of the bottle. But keep going.
Okay. Another reason weighed particularly with the members from this state against the insertion of a Bill of Rights. Such bills generally begin with declaring that all men are by nature born free. Now, we should make that declaration with a very bad grace when a large part of our property consists in men who are actually born slaves. As to the clause guaranteeing to each state a republican form of government being inserted near the end of the Constitution, the general observed that it was as binding as if it had been inserted in the first article. The Constitution takes its effect from the ratification, and every part of it is to be ratified at the same time, and not one clause before the other. But he thought there was a peculiar propriety in inserting it where it was, as it was necessary to form the government before that government could guarantee anything.
Okay, so now Colonel Mason, and this is not the Colonel George Mason from Virginia, but Colonel Mason then kind of speaks up, and that's the end of the day. And then the debates in convention kind of really kick off, and they actually start going through the debates. And again, Charles Cokes Pinckney, it's not Coatsworth. This is Mr. Pinckney, not the General Pinckney. And so he actually drills into some very specific principles that are being brought up regarding the Constitution. The first one being commerce. The next one being unicameral. The next one being sovereign and forms of government. Those are the comments that we're going to highlight in and diving into this. But technically, I mean, we're pretty close to, you know, finishing the South Carolina debates, because in all actuality, there's only 84 pages here. I mean, some of the other debates are several hundred pages, but in this one, this is kind of one of the shorter ones, because in a way, South Carolina, even though they debated it, it was pretty clear that they had and they felt compelled, that's a good word. They felt compelled that they must ratify it, because I believe, remember, it was brought up that if they don't take this deal and it goes back and actually gets reworked, slavery may be off the table next time. And so Georgia rubber stamped the Constitution, one, because it protected their slavery, and secondly, it protected their sovereignty as a state. So that's why they didn't even really debate it. They just said, yeah, rubber stamped it. You know, they elected people to go and have some pastries and tea, you know, for a day or two, and then, you know, sign some formal papers and go home. Because, you know, that's when I look at all of the states that actually rubber stamped the Constitution, it was really more of a feel good moment. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Where it wasn't like where this Constitution was being vigorously debated, where it was very close to possibly not being ratified. And Massachusetts was one of those, as we know. But let's dive into what Mr. Pinckney says about the commerce.
I do not agree with him so far as to suppose that commerce is generally cheating. I think there are some kinds of commerce not only fair and valuable, but such as ought to be encouraged by government. I agree with him in this general principle that all the great objects of government should be subservient to the increase of agriculture and the support of the landed interest, and that commerce should only be so far attended to as it may serve to improve and strengthen them, that the object of a republic is to render its citizens virtuous and happy, and that an unlimited foreign commerce can seldom fail to have a contrary tendency.
Okay, so he's, this is really a snapshot of helping you see the paradigm, and I've mentioned this before, but I don't mention it a lot, but there, if the time of the Constitution in Britain, and as a matter of fact, I did cover this regarding the song Jerusalem, because Jerusalem is kind of like the national anthem for Britain, the unofficial national anthem. And if you read the words, this, the word, and that was written at the very beginning of the 19th century, of the early 1800s. And so prior to the writing of the song, it became very obvious that the factories that were being built and created in England, and basically this was all, you know, they were well underway in 1776 when Adams. Come on here. It's a simple name too. Adam Smith. It wasn't Adams' last name. His first name was Adam Smith. He wrote the book The Wealth of Nations, a Scottish professor of economics. And in 1776, he actually dove into the development of processes within factories and the importance of process improvement and protecting your processes so your competitors couldn't get involved or, you know, duplicate what you're doing. That, you know, it was incumbent upon them to actually preserve and protect those types of things. And so, and technically, when we look at the Constitution, the paradigm was not to protect patents or inventions for a long period of time. It was very limited because they wanted to ensure that, you know, inventors would invent, but they didn't. The intent wasn't to create these permanent, you know, I'll just say fixtures that only that person can produce that type of a product. That they also wanted competition. So when we look at the copyrights and the patents and those types of things that are now perpetually forever, are you kidding me? That was never the intent, and the Constitution's clear, for a limited time. And so, you know, all of these, I'm in a rat hole, but this is because I know there's lots of rock and roll and musical artists who are actually selling their catalog because they believe that they have a perpetual patent and copyright on their material and their work. So towards the end of their life, they're making millions of dollars by selling it to a group, an investor group, like what David Bowie did in the early 2000s, so that he could make $50 million on his current work that he had copyrights to and his future work. And that gave him the money to buy his previous work that his former manager was basically taking, you know, making heads over heels all on his creativity. So he wanted to get that stuff back. So that's what he did, and that's why he did it. I'm sorry about that. But anyway, I have a phone around here, and I have no idea where it's at. I'll just let it ring. Bottom line is that when we look at this time in space of industries and so forth, what we have is we have this change that's already begun in the development of factories and production, shifting away from an agrarian society to a factory or industrial society. And most people think the Industrial Revolution was after the framing of the nation. It came to America a little later, but it actually was already starting. And in England, like I said, if you go read the words of Jerusalem, it'll, you know, wow, you go, these evil satanic mills or something like that. You know, it's interesting. The point is that actually this became a heated debate between Thomas Jefferson, who believed an agrarian society was a more moral society than a factory or industrial. And basically Alexander Hamilton was saying, no, America needs to get quickly engaged in an industrial society. And so anyway, and the interesting thing regarding the morality of the industrial society was, you know, as the factories aged and they weren't up to date with the new processes and so forth, it was cheaper to build a new factory, you know, in an area where the land was cheaper and the labor was cheaper. So what ended up happening is what we call rust belts. The rust belts, the initial rust belts, you know, initially formed up in New England, and then they went down, you know, to the mid-Atlantic and so forth, to eventually they got into the South. And over time, you can see the stages of rust belts that were occurring in America, because again, you know, why rebuild a new factory in the expensive land and the expensive labor when it was just easier to shift and move away from, you know, that to a cheaper commerce. And that's why, you know, you can actually see factories and industries literally went from the East Coast across the United States to the West Coast. Anyway, a little bit too much information probably, but let's go ahead and read the next one. Unicameral.
Okay.
This is a long one, so go ahead and let's just kind of read through what we can.
Okay.
Okay.
All right. In Pennsylvania and Georgia, the whole powers of government are lodged in the legislative body of a single branch over which there is no control, nor are there executives or judicials from their connection and necessary dependence on the legislature capable of strictly executing their respective offices. In all the other states except Maryland, Massachusetts, and New York, they are only so far improved as to have a legislature with two branches which completely involve and swallow up all the powers of their government, and neither of these are the judicial or executive placed in that form or independent situation which can alone secure the safety of the people or the justice administration of the laws. In Maryland, one branch of their legislature is a Senate chosen for 5 years by electors chosen by the people. The knowledge and firmness which this body have upon all occasions displayed not only in the exercise of their legislative duties, but in withstanding and defeating such of the projects of the other house as appeared to them founded in local and personal motives, have long since convinced me that the Senate of Maryland is the best model of a Senate that has yet been offered to the Union, that it is capable of correcting many of the vices of the other parts of their Constitution, and in a great measure, atoning for those defects which, in common with the states I have mentioned, are but too evident in their execution, the want of stability and independence in the judicial and executive departments. In Massachusetts, we find the principle of legislation more improved by the revisionary power which is given to their governor and the independence of their judges. In New York, the same improvement in legislation has taken place as in Massachusetts, but here, from the executives being elected by the great body of the people, holding his office for 3 years and being re-eligible, from the appointment to offices being taken from the legislature and placed in a select council, I think their constitution is, upon the whole, the best in the Union. Its faults are the want of permanent salaries to their judges and giving to their executive the nomination to offices, which is, in fact, giving him the appointment.
Okay, excellent. So now we're going into break, and so we'll be right back after this break, and we can expound upon, you know, this concept of unicameral versus bicameral. But anyway, we'll be right back after this. Thank you so much. If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance.
In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.
As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416. Okay, so this first paragraph that you read identifies the unique differences between the current governments of the state. In other words, what they're doing in forming this federal government of three branches, with the legislative branch having a unicameral and a very specific division between what the House of Representatives, the representatives for the people do versus the representatives of the state government do. In other words, this was a look and a view of a form of government that no one had ever imagined before, in going to this length of checks and balances and so forth. And as a matter of fact, they didn't start saying, okay, we got to build a government with the best checks and balances. That's not how it happened. It happened at different layers and at different levels, but that's what ended up becoming the byproduct of that. And so as you kind of examine this and you go through this, he's really giving you a report as the clear disparities between the different states and how they were functioning as governments, and how the uniqueness and the sovereignty, because he's going to really kind of deal with that as well, that the sovereignty is, you know, going to be important, because how a state is functioning, I've said this before. Had the Constitution laid it out in print that said every state government needs to mold and model itself under, you know, in the same style and framework as the U.S. Constitution for the federal government, all of these states would have had what would have been easily their contention of, we can't accept this because they're trying to create a whole new government. What's wrong with the government that we have? And so they all would have been, oh yeah, we're rejecting this. They would have rejected the U.S. Constitution. This is why I have said this, that the U.S. Constitution is the exemplar for all governments to basically model itself, so that the liberty is best protected, the sovereignty of the citizens and the liberty of the citizens and the citizens' governments are best protected. Therefore, as we kind of go down and dive into this even more and more, he's going to kind of expose these concepts and these ideas. Not that we have to change, but this Constitution is capable of dealing with the nuances and the differences, because it's not hard and rigid. We already saw in Massachusetts, I mean, you probably remember, Tammy, that we saw in Massachusetts how it talked about the different types of judges and the different types of laws, from common law of one type of common law in another state and so forth, that the federal government was framed in a certain way that it was capable of being flexible in dealing with how those states were functioning within their legal system. Right? You're on mute. You need to unmute yourself, by the way. But anyway, right?
Right.
Okay. So,
sorry, I didn't know I was muted.
I figured you were just giving me this long monologue. Anyway, so So Massachusetts identified this in a single or myopically because of the judiciary. Why is the judiciary, you know, not declaring this or that? Well, because if they did, then that's all they could do. And so he's kind of going through this to basically help people see what the great, you know, this great design really is in contrast to what they currently got at the state level. So keep going. Go ahead.
Okay, so we're in sovereign, correct?
I think so. That's where you basically,
Okay. I just want to make sure you were there, too. In every government, there necessarily exists a power from which there is no appeal, and which, for that reason, may be formed absolute and uncontrollable. The person or assembly in whom this power resides is called the sovereign or supreme power of the state.
Okay. So, in every government, there necessarily exists a power from which there is no appeal, and which, for that reason, may be formed absolute and uncontrollable. So, this is, he's talking about what sovereignty is. With us, the sovereignty of the union is in the people.
Uh-huh.
Okay. So, does that mean that we're a democracy, that, you know, the people have a say in creating the laws? No. The sovereignty is in the people of who represents them. This goes back to the design and some of the arguments during the Constitutional Convention of what is appropriate representation. Can we properly be represented by a million people? Heck no. We're not, when we have a million people sharing one representative, there's no way we're getting our actual representation. And so now he's diving into the forms of government and so forth, where he kind of covers a lot of little, you know, differences of despotism, anarchy, and so forth. So let's go ahead and cover this next one now.
Okay. One of the best political and moral writers, Paley, a deacon of Carlisle, Volume 2, 174, 175, I have met with, enumerates three principal forms of government, which he says are to be regarded rather as the simple forms, by some combination and intermixture of which all actual governments are composed, than as any were existing in a pure and elementary state. These forms are, first, despotism, or absolute monarchy, where the legislature is in a single person. Second, an aristocracy, where the legislature is in a select assembly, the members of which either fill up by election the vacancies in their own body, or succeed to it by inheritance, property, tenure of lands, or in respect of some personal right or qualification. Third, a republic, where the people at large, either collectively or by representation, form the legislature. The separate advantages of monarchy are unity of counsel, decision and secrecy, and dispatch. The military strength and energy resulting from these qualities of a government, the exclusion of popular and aristocratical contentions, the preventing by a known rule of succession all competition for the supreme power, thereby repressing the dangerous hopes and intrigues of aspiring citizens. The dangers of a monarchy are tyranny, expense, exactions, military dominations, unnecessary wars, ignorance in the governors of the interest and accommodation of the people, and a consequent deficiency of salutary regulations, want of constancy, of uniformity in the rules of government, and, proceeding from thence, insecurity of persons and property. The separate advantage of an aristocracy is the wisdom that may be expected from experience and education. A permanent council naturally possesses experience, and the members will always be educated with a view to the stations they are destined by their birth to occupy. The mischiefs of an aristocracy are dissensions in the ruling order of the state, an oppression of the lower orders by the privilege of the higher, and by laws partial to the separate interests of the lawmakers. The advantages of a republic are liberty, exemption from needless restrictions, equal laws, public spirit, adverseness, to war, frugality, above all, the opportunities afforded to men of every description of producing their abilities and counsels to public observation, and the exciting to the service of commonwealth the faculties of its best citizens. The evils of a republic are dissensions, tumults, factions, the attempts of ambitious citizens to possess power, the confusion and clamor which are the inevitable consequence of propounding questions of state to the discussion of large popular assemblies, the delay and disclosure of the public councils, and too often the imbecility of the laws. A mixed government is composed by the combination of two or more of the simple forms above described, and in whatever proportion each form enters into the constitution of government, in the same proportion may both the advantages and evils which have been attributed to that form be expected.
Okay, so he kind of dove into these different forms of government, and he kind of points out the evils of a republic towards the very end there. And he kind of mentions the dissensions, tumults, and factions, the attempts of ambitious citizens to possess power. So here's the question. When we look at this republican form of government that the Constitution has created, what form of power is capable, if we are in compliance of the Constitution, if every public servant is fully complying to, what types of powers can they acquire, can they amass? Well, it would basically be going from one station to the next to the next. In other words, the level of power may be going from a 2-year terms of, you know, service to a 6-year term of service, going from the House of Representatives into the Senate, where now you don't have to run a campaign every 2 years and you can focus and what have you. But bottom line, there's no way you can make more money. You can't get paid to write laws. That's illegal. The Constitution doesn't allow that. The only compensation you're to receive is for your time. The way Congress operates today, where the lobbyists actually pour money into Congress, paying each congressional member based on how they vote on the bills in committee. Are you aware of this? Are you aware
yes,
that that's what
actually
happens?
Actually, you told me about it.
Okay. So, yeah, and there's a movie called The Swamp that actually exposes this. This is how, and people go, well, hold on here. How is it that Nancy Pelosi or whoever the leader of the Democratic Party in Congress and the leader of the House, you got leaders of the Republican and Democratic Party in both houses. And in both of those houses, they receive money from lobbyists that go into these war chests. And what happens with the money that each individual congressperson gets goes into their own campaign chest. Now, think about this, folks. How is this legitimate when a person in the House of Representatives like Liz Cheney obtains millions and millions of dollars based on her votes in Congress and creates this war chest to be able to come back to Wyoming and run a campaign against, you know, any type of an opponent that, you know, there's no way they can financially compete. So the only...
Well, isn't it true, even at the state legislature, they lobbyists will pay legislators to go to dinner with them?
Well, so I don't think that they get paid. I think that they become campaign contributions. So here's the problem. Mm-hmm. This, you want to fix this problem? We have to clarify, because who actually do these people represent? They represent, there's only two representatives for every public servant. They only represent two constituents. The primary constituent is the Constitution. They're to represent that Constitution and support it by the letter, period. Don't care how they feel, they have to support that thing. That is their primary constituent, right or wrong.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah. Well, yeah.
All right. And then the other constituent is they actually have to support their voters who they represent. And technically, the Senate is to represent the state legislature. even though they're voted in by the people, that doesn't matter. The Constitution mandates that they must provide the state legislature their equal suffrage. So when we kind of look at how things, you know, are supposed to be, then how is it that a company can come along? Because we have actually allowed the corruption. It used to be illegal for a congressperson to buy votes. In other words, on the day of election, your Congress, or actually any person, I mean, I think every state in the union at the time of the Constitution made it illegal for any candidate to be able to buy drinks, you know, on election day or leading up to election day. They just made it impossible for people to use money to buy votes. Oh, okay, so they're not buying you a drink. But what if they're buying you health care? What if they're buying you services? What if they're buying you, you know, a job? They can't. Yeah. They can't do that. They don't have the authority because the government's, you know, very limited and defined. They can only, they can't get involved in commerce within the states. So if they were actually supporting the Constitution, they wouldn't even be able to be corrupt. The Constitution wouldn't allow it. But bottom line, there is this corruption that they've started stewing into this cauldron. The best way to end and actually get rid of the cauldron altogether is what we talked about years ago, back in 2020, when I was basically doing the Bill of Rights for the 21st century. And one of the most important Bill of Rights from the 21st century that needed to start at the county level and get into the state level is that no person that is running for office in the county can take money from any other person that does not live within the county or any business. And it's got to be a small business that only originates and operates in that county only. Mm-hmm. In other words, that way, if Walmart is operating, and Walmart is operating in every county almost in the United States, then they can't contribute money. Because if they do, they actually can filter money from one state over to another state. And mm-hmm. that means that their influence is not proper. It's not regional within the county only. So making all, the term is called make all elections local. So that the only way these people can actually fund a campaign, this base, so what this would actually do, it would actually hurt the campaign business, because the TVs and the radios and all the advertising dollars would not be pouring into this evil mainstream media that makes billions of dollars every election. What are we to do? Is it not interesting how they make so much money off the election itself? So how are they not corrupted?
Right.
Okay. So in other words, they don't want to shine the light on this impropriety and this repugnant consideration of people being able to buy votes and influence. So, like I said, there are very specific ways of dealing with this and making all elections local. I know that is it's a great catch, because it is very concise as to what the solution is. But this is how we actually can enforce it, because as we really tie things down, let's just say there's a guy that actually works with Amazon, right? He's an Amazon retailer, and maybe he, you know, has this relationship, you know, as a reseller for Amazon. Maybe Amazon would be able to funnel money into him to be able to actually throw money into the election. The bottom line is every dollar has to be proven to actually come from the profits or proceeds from local sales.
Yeah.
Okay, so what this does, if you actually create this rule of all elections are to be local, that money must come from within that county. It must originate and be organic to the county. That way, these guys would actually have to have financial books to prove how that money that they got, because you know as well as I do, these resellers that may be just sitting in your county, they're doing most of their transactions throughout the state or throughout other states.
Mm-hmm.
And so that they're making money off of sales that have nothing to do with your county. And so, therefore, they actually have to prove that the profits that they're receiving or, you know, the transactions that they're making money off of actually has occurred within your county. This is how we actually close the door on undue influence. Because I'm telling you, folks, if they can find a way to funnel money in, this is how they corrupt. And so, anyway, we got about 7 minutes left. Let me see here. Where you got Mr. Charles Pickney again talking about gold, money, and so forth. And he talks about the importance of the solid coin currency. Let's go ahead.
Okay. I apprehend these general reasonings will be found true in respect to paper money, that experience has shown that in every state where it has been practiced since the Revolution, it always carries the gold and silver out of the country and impoverishes it. That while it remains, all of the foreign merchants trading in America must suffer and lose by it. Therefore, that it must ever be a discouragement to commerce, that every medium of trade should have an intrinsic value which paper money has not. Gold and silver are therefore the fittest for this medium, as they are an equivalent which paper can never be. That debtors in the assemblies will, whenever they can, make paper money with fraudulent views. That in those states where the credit of the paper money has been best supported, the bills have never kept to their nominal value in circulation, but have constantly depreciated to a certain degree. I consider it as a granted position that while the productions of a state are useful to other countries and can find a ready sale at foreign markets, there can be no doubt of their always being able to command a sufficient sum in specie to answer as a medium for the purpose of carrying on this commerce, provided there is no paper money or other means of conducting it.
Okay, so here he points out that the way the federal government has been framed, they can only function with coin species, in other words, gold and silver. Now, one of the things that they kind of realized was, well, gold and silver has to be the backbone or, you know, the foundation, but they needed to be able to categorize let's just say, smaller denominations, because, you know, things wouldn't always be an ounce or a quarter ounce or what have you, to get to a point of a smaller denomination of a silver dollar or a half dollar or a quarter dollar, you know, they needed to get to something different. This is why they came up with dimes, a silver dime, which was the next and the smallest silver denomination. Then they would go to nickel for the 5 cents, and then they went to copper for the pennies. And actually, if I remember correctly, they used different types of species throughout time because of, you know, I'll just say mining problems, what have you, war, what, I don't know. But they've tried to change that, and the only way they could literally change it effectively or to do it right would require an amendment. Does that make sense? As long as they're abiding by the gold and silver axiom, that's what their basis is, and then they're providing some intermediate species to actually allow for the small offsets, which they did a brilliant job in the very first act of the Treasury in establishing, you know, the gold and silver coins. Down the road, they got to a point where a person didn't want to walk down the road, you know, walk into town with, you know, that much gold and silver in their pockets or that much change or coins in their pockets. So they kind of transmuted a, you know, a gold dollar to a $20 bill. And so that if you had a $20 bill, that would add up to one gold ounce. And a silver dollar was literally a single bill. So they started utilizing currency that was commutable. In other words, that bill was tied to a silver dollar. For every bill that they had silver dollars in currency, in, you know, in the system, out in circulation. So that way that they could always, there should never be a point where you go to basically commute your bills into gold or silver to where you wouldn't have that. And nine times out of 10, economies were really kind of based on the transactions and the flows and so forth, right? And in most cases, there were in the super rural areas, and I don't want to say, you know, Wyoming is rustic like that, but, you know, I would imagine that in many cases, there may have been dollar pricing on dry goods, you know, things that the general store would be providing way back in the old West, where there was a ledger. And a person would owe, and they would, you know, pay their bills when some species came in, because sometimes they wouldn't have enough species. Because what would happen if you're buying stuff from out of town? That species would leave town. Doesn't mean you're still not making and so forth, but the flow of the gold and silver was not as liquid as one would have liked, because you have all of these look at each state, look at the, you know, the state bank, and then, okay, is everybody going to go to the state bank for their currency? No, they want to have a local bank. So the banking system to support the people literally required this networking. Does that make sense? Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, they tried to create the perfect model. The perfect model is not digital. It is not, you know, paperless. It is coins and commutable. That everything has to be commutable, that you should be able to liquidate your bank account with a bank and walk away in gold, silver, and whatever the species is, you know, in coin and bars, what have you, to basically say, okay, I now have my wealth, I've liquidated, and it now is in my possession. That is the whole concept of property. Because it doesn't matter what all your property is. You can have clothes, cars, land, airplanes, boats, what have you. But to liquidate everything has a value. You liquidate all of that into the gold. That is the sum of your property. And so when they take away and say you no longer can have the gold and silver, they have literally taken away really your ability to have property.
I've never thought about it like that.
Right. So let's read this last comment here on gold money.
Okay. But above all, how much will this section tend to restore your credit with foreigners to rescue your national character from that contempt which must ever follow the most flagrant violations of public faith and private honesty? No more shall tender laws drive their...
I'm sorry. We're running out of time. We'll have to pick this one.
Yeah,
we'll pick this one up. And it looks like what we'll do is we'll wrap up this and South Carolina tomorrow. And what we'll do is dive into the next ratification debate. And I don't have it open, but I can tell you in, let me see, a little statehood order. And so the next ratification debate will be Virginia. So we'll get into the big, meaty one. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, process. This is what is referred to as Republic Review. Please read my argument for Republic Review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.